Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and I just want to thank you for joining the Dr. Drew podcast and supporting the Corolla Pirate Ship here at the Corolla Network. And please, just a reminder, tell a friend about these podcasts. That is how this thing grows organically, and that is how we want this to grow. We want it to be a community of people that connect, and we talk about interesting things. And by the way, feel free to give us feedback and stuff, particularly for my show, that you'd like to hear. We'll be happy to set it up on the program. And again, tell a friend and keep this pirate ship afloat.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Couple of bits of business before I really get into it here. First of all, I have an upper respiratory infection, otherwise known as a cold, so I apologize for any sneezing or schnitzing or anything that goes on here. In fact, I've got to reach for my snot rags before we get started and take them as far away from my guest as possible. I do not want to infect him. My guest is Dr. Harry Harutunian. He is the physician director, professional and residential programs at the Betty Ford Center. Betty Ford obviously has always been, and I believe will always be, at the forefront of addiction treatment, quality addiction treatment, which it's a nefarious thing to maintain and to find in this country today. But he and I will get into that. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The book, the new book, which I recommend, I've had a chance to look at, I recommend very highly. It's just called Being Sober, a step-by-step guide to getting to, getting through, and living in recovery. It is the real deal. He developed a recovery lecture, Recovery 101. He's an international speaker on topics of addiction. Again, go to drdrew.com or Amazon to click through and get the book, Being Sober. It is worth your time and effort. Dr. Harutunian also can be reached through the Betty Ford website. Is that true?
Or at least you can. Yes.
It's www.bettyfordcenter.org. And, of course, we'll put the links to all this stuff up at drdrew.com. Before we get into our conversation, though, I want to give a little love to our friends over at Lumosity, which hopefully will make the Corolla people happy and keep me on the air here. But the interesting thing about Lumosity, I just had a patient come in yesterday who was having formal treatment for cognitive problems, mental problems, thinking problems after a head injury. And I'll be damned if a lot of it didn't look like the exercise on Lumosity website. So what this is at Lumosity.com is games based on the science of neuroplasticity designed to help the brain's performance. I've been playing the games with Lumosity. I particularly like the Memory Matrix because it helps me focus and get my memory going again before I get on the air. They have 40 million people using these games. It's easy to get started at Lumosity, and of course the games are fun. You can set it up online and specifically dial in the kinds of games that you want that are going to give you the sorts of goals you hope to attain. And then, of course, you get the feedback online. You can play anywhere from your computer, iPad, iPhone, of course, with the Lumosity app. Take a few minutes a day, so I want you to go to Lumosity.com, click the Start Training button to create your own personalized program, your trainer for your brain, and then start playing your first game. Again, that's Lumosity.com, and tell them you please heard it from me, Dr. Drew. Now, that having been said, I want to get out to Dr. Harutunian and our addiction conversation here. We also will take calls toward later in the program as well. So I've got so much I want to talk to you about. Let me start with we have not discussed this yet, so I don't know if you feel the same way I do, but I suspect you do. The frustration of dealing with addiction today, because there's so many I feel like, in fact, I'm going to give a lecture later in the spring where I call it the blind man and the elephant, where there are all these blind men looking at the elephant, and one says, well, it has these big trunk-like big feet and or big it's like a tree, and the other one says no, it's long like a hose, and another one says, well, it's got a tail, it's very coarse, you know, everyone sees something different. Yet I suspect you and I see something that's the same, that these other people that are only looking at the feet or the trunk or the ears are messing this up badly. Do you agree with that?
I agree completely. It's kind of the perfect storm. I think that patients have to own it on the denial end, of course.
Okay, so first thing, we patients are not without their own responsibility. That's some right. of them know what they're doing when they work the doctors and go to the pain medicine, all that kind of stuff. All right, so the patient part, yeah.
Yeah, and the doctor part, the ignorance, the lack of training is really embarrassing.
Stunning. Yeah. It's stunning. Now, the problem with the training, though, I go and lecture the medical students at USC, and I used to have third-year students on my unit, and we would do that was a good job. We would really give them a sensibility about addiction, and most of them, we'd have them for like 2 to 4 weeks. And by the end of it, they would either say, wow, I understand this, I can feel it, I can identify it, or I kind of see the earmarks, I know to get out from under this and refer it if I see it again in my life, and how not to get stuck in it. But I must have trained 200 students? That's not very many.
Yeah, it's not very many. We're proud to say that the Betty Ford Center's Summer Institute for Medical Students had about 90 schools in attendance last year.
Great.
And they'll come for a week-long experience with treatment, learn about the disease of addiction, that it is treatable, not curable, but that there is hope, and they'll take it to their patients. They also learn about how the disease particularly affects people in our profession.
Physicians. I mean, with addiction.
That's right.
Yeah.
Is that
your area of interest right now?
Yeah. Primarily, I deal with the professionals, pilots, lawyers, physicians, and so forth,
they're
entertainers,
tough.
Athletes. They're tough. Very difficult.
What's the give me the basic cliff notes on that. I mean, each is a little bit different. Here's my experience. Let's start with the actors and media people first. My biggest frustration with that group, well, there's a lot of them, I think about it, but the biggest one, my biggest fear, is they go right back to work. They never take the time to focus on their recovery. And they get the sober trainers and all this kind of stuff, but they're really not all the way into their recovery. And recovery is such a delicate process that if you're distracted by all the gratification, narcissistic gratification particularly, of their work, it tends not to go so well if they don't take the time out.
You know, my experience. It all comes down to one word, I think, entitlement. People just feel that they deserve to be able to leave the planet, get loaded when they need to, that they can handle it. They never quite grasp that first step, the powerlessness and the surrender. Occasionally become temporarily compliant, only to take back their power and disease just.
What do you do with those? I know
up.
Exactly what you're talking about. What do you do with them?
Well, you have to keep them in treatment and engage them long enough. That's for sure.
Which is how long?
Well, for us with healthcare professionals, about 90 days.
And that's pretty short, actually, right?
Yeah, but 90 days is the beginning of their treatment.
Right, right.
The entire 30-day model is a wash as far as I'm concerned.
John, I agree with you.
With the combinations that people are using now, they're still detoxing at 35 and 45
Absolutely.
Days. No question.
Up to 6 months, easily.
And then their post-acute withdrawal.
Absolutely.
But if we can engage them as their own advocate by 90 days, that next aftercare period is the critical. It really doesn't make all that much of a difference what kind of treatment they get up front. It's that aftercare that really, really is the piece. And the hook is, of course, in physicians and pilots, the outstanding outcome in long-term care is the monitoring piece. And
they are checking the urine regularly.
Checking the urine, finding out if they're going to their program, are they doing their counseling work, and so forth.
Well, so with physicians and pilots, let's say, they are usually so invested in their profession. It's so deeply in their identity that they don't you can hold that as the sword of Damocles over their head, and they don't want to lose that.
That's right.
So it keeps them engaged over time. And I have found that, too. If you get them off the drugs, which is, by the way, hard. They're slippery. They are very slippery. So you can get
all the tricks.
Yeah, if you can get into that first 90 days. But if you can get them engaged, which is what you're saying, they stay with it a little better. But they need long, long. I remember the guy became my partner at the chemical dependence unit I ran for many years. I had my eye on him. He's a recovering physician. I kept wanting to get him in. He kept saying, I can't. Mm-hmm. His diversion people said no. His sponsor said no. Until one day they started saying yes. On a limited basis. And that took about 6 years to get him from he was probably 7 years into sobriety, but it was 6 years of me pursuing him before he was able to actually do the work.
Well, if you're dealing with human doings instead of human beings, it's going to happen every time. You summed it all up. People just whether they're entertainers or they're physicians, they want to get back to work.
Yeah.
In that 90 days, we really get them to be their own advocate and want to live. The fundamental understanding that has to come across is that this is a fatal disease and that unless you engage in lifelong treatment and recovery in this disease, it's going to get you.
Why do we have such trouble communicating to the populace at large that this is fatal? When my patients die, people are shocked. When my patients die, I feel like an oncologist. Of course some die. You can't save them all.
You know, the old wisdom is self will run riot, and that is that people just think that they can do it differently.
No, I get the patience, but why the public? Why can't they get their head around the fact that this kills people routinely? They want to make excuses for it. They want to make it, they say that it's exceptional. I mean, think of all the celebrities that have died recently from addiction. It's just unbelievable.
I think you wouldn't have a tough time convincing someone that malignant melanoma is going to kill those people. But when you're dealing with addiction, substance use, and abuse, it really does affect anyone who's eating, smoking, drinking, or drugging. One way or the other,
right?
And it they're directly involved. They want to take the heat off them, and will not own the ominous possibility that what they're doing could just backfire. It's like juggling chainsaws, you know.
Is it? Do you think it has something to do with our weird cultural and sort of political ideas about freedom
Entitlement, my God-given right to use.
Entitlement for sure, but also that self-will, that our ability to, that will comes from some sort of autonomous place rather than something that's biological and driven by all these systems that we know get dragged into addiction. Mm-hmm. We don't want to think about our volition being affected by substances. We don't like when things that affect our thinking or volition, we recoil from.
Yeah, we see it all the time. The typical addict, alcoholic feels that it's their body, their mind, their experience, their issue. The universal untruth that we hear all the time is my use never affected anyone else. Right. There's no universal consciousness. There's no universal body. It's the isolation that the addict and alcoholic flourish in, and you described it beautifully.
Yeah. I want you to help me keep writing this, my Elephant and the Blind Men symposium I'm going to tell. So I'm going to describe some of the blind men to you, and let's get into them. Pain management.
Oy vey.
Thank you. Because it gives me fits. Here's two bits of data that I think our listeners ought to recognize. One is the California Medical Association came out with a position paper on opiates for chronic pain. Position paper. And in it, they concluded no evidence that opiates and opioids have a use or utility or benefit in the setting of chronic pain. That was their position paper. Their action in response to it was, we need to monitor patients on opiates better. Not we need to stop using an ineffective and dangerous treatment, but it's the patient's fault. So we need to get the pharmacy systems going where we can monitor them better. Did you see that? It was about a year ago.
Yeah,
I was shocked. I was stunned. Yeah. And our formal professional societies are one of the blind men. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How would you design a program? What would you say that there should have been their response to that position paper?
Well, I'm not so sure about their response to that position paper. I think that the responsibility of the medical profession to deal with chronic pain issues is one of our most daunting tasks. We know that suffering is optional, and the way that we treat chronic pain just needs to be completely reworked. I was recently at the opioid REMS course for the American Academy of Family Physicians.
What's REMS? It's some acronym for something.
But anyway, this is how they're training physicians now for responsible opioid use.
Okay.
And the guy that was teaching the course was an addictionologist.
Which could mean many different things. That's one of my blind men. I'm going to put on my
list.
Which
was a little scary.
Yes. We'll go there shortly.
You know, this whole argument now of 12-step-based abstinence, gold therapy and treatment.
Hold on. We'll go there in a second. That's the most painful part of this for me, that people have sort of thrown in the towel on the hard work, the real work.
Yeah, look,
Let's stay with the chronic pain.
Let's stay on the chronic pain for sure. Yeah. I don't know of an issue that's harder. We have a pain management program now at the Betty Ford Center, and we're getting incredible results. Unfortunately, you can help 15 or 20 people at a time, and that's about it. We need them for 30 or 45 days.
Right.
They learn new non-opioid pain coping skills. We work with Qigong, we work with mindfulness, we work with meditation. They learn to deal with their pain. They retrain their brain.
Okay. Also, you take them off the opiates because the opiates are causing something called hyperalgesia.
Absolutely.
So the opiates are causing increasing and maintaining the pain.
About 100% of the people that we've detoxified get improvement off their opiates.
I would say my typical patient, and again, I'm typical meaning like 80 or 90% of them, we come in and we're obliged to ask their pain on a scale of 10. And by the way, I gave my hospital fits because in the first week after we would stop their opiates, their pain goes off the chart for a few days. And, you know, the hospital comes, well, you're allowing the patient to have 25 out of 10 pain. It's like, yeah, they'll be fine in about a week. If you keep giving the pain medicine, this is going to be a disaster. So anyway, they always come in and you ask, what is it on a scale of 10? What is the average answer, would you say? When they first come in the hospital.
12.
Yeah. 12 to 15 is where they typically are. Yeah. They never say 10.
Never say 10.
They always say more than 10. Right. It's the weirdest thing. Always.
For fear that you won't give them the same or bigger dosages of the medication.
It could be the addictive process motivating that. So 15 out of 10. And within 2 weeks, this has been my experience, 100% of them stop spontaneously talking about their pain.
That's absolutely true.
You need to evoke. You got to, how's your pain doing today? And they will tell you they're still having pain. But when they come in, that's all they talk about is their pain.
Right.
And after 2 weeks, they have to be prompted to get the pain. And I would say most of them, where does your scale go down to in most of those patients in that first 3 weeks, would you say?
2 to 6.
Yeah, I was going to say 4 to 6. That's mm-hmm. what I was going to say. 2 is good. If you're doing, if you get them to 2, that's – so you guys are doing something active, obviously, in there more than we were doing because we would get 4 to 6 just to
Well, the other part of it is that we get to work on the trauma histories. We get to work on all of the other issues that contribute to
their
pain.
Let's talk about the trauma thing. Do you remember when California first put in their pain management and end-of-life requirements for physicians?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so we all had to go to these symposiums put on by the pain management specialists and the end-of-life specialists. And I will never forget the first one I went to, probably in the 90s. That's when this all started, wasn't
it?
Yeah. The first one I went to a world-class pain management at a university, put on the symposium. The director of the program got up. And he goes, let me describe to you the chronic pain patient. And he gets the first thing he puts up there, he goes, funny thing about these patients, 96% of them have a history of physical or sexual abuse in childhood. Anyway, let me tell you about how to use opiates. I took my breath away. It's like I'm sitting in that room and right now watching it because it was so stunning to me. And not one further discussion about trauma in a 2-day symposium
other than that
funny thing, isn't it? What a funny thing.
That's right.
What do we do with that?
Well, certainly when in our program, the trauma work is essential, and it starts right from the very beginning. I have not seen a chronic pain patient without a trauma history.
Me too.
Yeah, I have not.
Yeah.
And we pull out all stops to deal with that.
What's your primary – what are the kinds of interventions you use for that? Is there one, or is it depends on the patient?
Well, we just have outstanding staff. We have trauma workshops. We have individual one-on-one trauma therapy.
EMDR, that kind of thing?
They do EMDR. Yes, absolutely.
Is there any particular area that you're excited about in trauma treatment? Because I think that's one of the – that's where we really have to focus some attention the next 10 years, I think.
And the trauma workshops, reliving the trauma has been extremely powerful.
Revivifying it.
Yep.
Really?
Uh-huh.
See, I'd be afraid that would make somebody go out and use.
Scared the hell out of me.
When you first
saw it,
yeah.
Yes, it really did. But I've seen the results for patients have been really – we have one extremely talented therapist working with patients who
– Is it like a psychodrama, like an evocative
therapy?
Yeah,
like a psychodrama. Mm-hmm.
Wow, and it works.
Yes.
Interesting. See, I'd be – I've actually done that with patients occasionally, mm-hmm. and – some of them dissociate in the middle of the experience.
Yeah, you have to pick.
But tolerating the dissociation and being with the therapist, right. somebody really skilled, I thought was very effective.
Right.
Although it scared me.
You know, none of this is done until those patients really commit to longer term treatment. Really, trauma needs about a year or two of recovery before you start to really delve into it.
Okay, well, that's what my rule.
We touch the surface.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And
my rule was always my rule. My sort of orientation was. I want to show you what's here because
right.
this is what's
that's exactly
this,
right.
And we're going to show it. We're going to dig in it. And we're going to show you that you can contain all that with our help. And then we're really going to get into what you've been sober 6 months.
As a strategy for non-opioid pain management, the knowledge that the patient has that my trauma may be related to the intensity of my pain is very comforting.
Do you do? Let's say it's not a pain patient, but I don't know about your world, but in my world, if somebody had severe enough addiction that they needed to see me. I'm not saying all addiction is caused by this, but if you have bad enough addiction that I get involved, trauma, pain or not, the trauma's there. Yeah. And do you do the same thing with other trauma patients that not without chronic pain?
Yes, same absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. How do we get the other part of this is I'm going to keep talking about my blind men in just a second, but as we talk about these 90-day programs and ongoing care and all this kind of stuff, cost immediately becomes the big issue. The step to do this work, I think it's why, by the way, all this replacement therapy is trickling in, because no one has the energy, the time, or the financial resources to get this work done on a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
How do we solve that problem? Or is that? Do you see that same problem?
Well, we see the same problem. Oddly enough, the Betty Fordson is more moderately priced when compared with some of the higher-priced treatment centers. But nonetheless, $30,000 or $40,000 for treatment is just simply undoable for many
times
people.
Times 3 months, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know Betty Fordson.
Well, no, that would be a 90-day program.
For 30?
No. Not for 30, but
it's 90 for 90.
I would say the range will go from 30 to 60 for various programs that will do 90 days worth of treatment in that price range. So you may find some people doing 90 days worth of treatment for $35,000.
That's a good deal.
Yes, it is.
I know
some people, very outstanding.
I was going to say, I know that sounds like a lot of money to people, but I would say the average good treatment is about 30 a month on average.
Mm-hmm.
You can. There's another. I was thinking of another. I've been working with Bob Forrest, Jason Waller, who's standing in the other room. Well, you'll appreciate this. We've been working on. I know, and you're sort of in this field over at your program, is trying to find ways to not focus on those first 30 days because people don't remember that anyway.
Right.
And find a way to stretch resources out over the year.
Yeah.
You know, find ways, which is really the big conundrum.
Yeah. One way or another, like any other chronic disease, hypertension, diabetes, we've got to figure out a way to monitor in aftercare. And the perfect example is that scary demographic of the young person, the 18 to 25-year-old young adult. We'll see them and have them in treatment for about 30 days. But the critical thing is, you know, if you don't make this thing fun, they're not going to do it. If you don't give them their life back, they're not going to do it. We have an extraordinary partnership with Northbound Treatment, for example, down in Orange County.
That's Jason's thing. They're very good.
Jason
very
and Keenan. It's outstanding. And they'll take those patients for the next year or two or three. Sober college, sober living, monitoring.
Well, and having those entertaining, interesting objects to attach to and identify with, like Jason. I mean, Jason's such a great role model for them. That's why I like sending him stuff his way.
Mm-hmm.
He can enroll them. That's you and I can't do that.
Yeah, that's right. But you asked a very good question. What about the people who can't afford it? What's going to happen? Well, this is why the Betty Ford Center and now Hazleton perhaps are merging. New resources to allow people access to treatment on an outpatient basis. And that's not necessarily a bad thing for someone's first try to interrupt the disease. Occasionally, with someone who's had lots of relapses, our detoxification period can be extended, but we're still going to have them under our care. Their aftercare follow-up in the core program is very significant, and the goal is abstinence-based treatment. But there is that subunit of patients that may need extended medical assistance.
So we're talking about harm avoidance? Are we talking about replacement?
I beg your pardon?
Are we talking about replacement therapies?
Yeah, we're talking about naltrexone. We're talking about Suboxone. We're talking
Those are two very different drugs.
Very
camps.
Different drugs. Yeah. But we're talking about those options for patients that
The problem with let's get in now to the addictionologists and these replacement therapies, mm-hmm. because it's very complicated.
Very complicated.
There's no doubt that Suboxone can save lives for mm-hmm. people with no resources and no motivation and mm-hmm. no whatever. And some people can't stay sober without it. The problem is the enthusiasm around this. I literally had a patient last week mm-hmm. who was doing he'd been in recovery, mm-hmm. out, back in recovery, doing very well, mm-hmm. doing really well. Much better than I thought. Heroin. Mm-hmm. Has a doctor he's meeting with, his mm-hmm. saying to him, You can't stay sober without this drug. You have to take this drug.
Oh, I hate it when that happens.
It's the scariest thing that happens a lot.
You know, Suboxone and getting off Suboxone at those low doses is as difficult as methadone ever was.
Yes, it's 2 weeks of hell.
Very painful, and yeah. I will get people who have been exposed to it time and time. Don't give me that stuff. You'll hear a lot of that. No, there's been a small subgroup of patients who have done well with it. I think what you're going to – look, let's call a spade, big farmers involved in this.
Well, big time.
Okay, big time.
But the problem is, though, that I hate blaming big pharma because they're just doing what they do. You know what I mean? They don't do anything different ever. But my problem has always been NIDA, whom I love, and the researchers who don't have all that clinical experience. Their researchers have just signed off on this. This is just it. And it's really where a lot of practitioners who aren't so sophisticated are looking and getting that message.
Well, it's an easier, softer way.
Of course. The addict. You tell an addict you have to take an opiate? Of course.
It's an easier, softer way. And I'm not blaming Big Pharma. They do what they do, and they do it very well. And creating a new business model is one of the things they do the best. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you wind up gathering the sad evidence of those people who do relapse, who do overdose. You know what the numbers are like now. Yeah. And by the way, your book that you did with Marv Seppel and Bill White, I enjoyed tremendously.
Oh, thank you. Thank
Outstanding
thank you.
Piece of work. You all should read it. I think that they're going to create a model of really hijacking or holding treatment centers at hostage, addictionologists at hostage.
Meaning
that
what?
Is, they're going to have bad outcomes, and there will be some test cases that say
legal cases.
You know, yes,
that you're liable because you didn't use Suboxone.
Yep. This kid OD'd. Yep. He's gone.
Yep.
You're to blame. Mass yep. action suits, and suddenly a malpractice case. It's that old tort thing. And
so what? That's going to that may be happening already.
It is happening already.
So let's rearticulate that people get that is that we as physicians people this is how pain management got going by the way
you
if
got
you
it.
Remember
you got
people
it.
Forget the fact that doctors were not just malpractice but criminally prosecuted for
criminally
not treating
prosecuted.
Pain so we were told you got to treat pain
that's
okay
right.
here it comes
right.
we got stuff for that here it goes and then now it's the doctor's fault that it's too much
right.
well it is. But you know it started with the legal system.
Jayco got involved and it became the fifth vital sign.
Yeah. Well, which is, again, the stuff I give everybody fits
That's
with
right.
by not treating pain in the first week after withdrawal because the pain is terrible, and then they don't talk about it anymore. And they don't remember when they were in it, by the way. They forget that whole week. You've had that experience, too, I'm sure.
I have.
Yeah. Stuff gets me very excited. So what are we going to do when that's going to be game over, I'm afraid, when the liability is so great if you don't use Suboxone. Maybe there's a way to get patients to sign a release saying, you know, I accept that I could take it, but I'm not going to, or it's on my own volition that I'm not.
We've done that. I mean, you have to document, but we've certainly done that with people who make that decision that I want to try that without. Look, there are still places that do outstanding work with patients like the ranch out there in Desert Hot Springs with a social model,
yeah,
you know, where patients detoxify the old-fashioned way.
Just
and
sit
do,
on them.
You know, and people wear that abstinence-based recovery with some pride.
Yeah.
It still has to be our goal. I think that the whole Suboxone thing is a unfortunate diversion right now.
Let me ask this, and I don't know if this is still true or not, but when physicians you would be able to answer me this, right? If a physician is going to back to work, let's say it's a surgeon particularly, and I know this is true for pilots, they're going to go back to work, they have to be completely abstinent. Is that true? At least from opiates and benzodiazepines, mind-altering.
That's correct.
why, my question always is the following. If Suboxone is so wonderful to return people to their flourishing existence, why do we never use that on our peers, physician peers, ever?
They couldn't work.
Right. And they're not the same.
That's right.
They're
they
not
couldn't
the
work.
Same.
It's not today.
And so why we? It's good for our patients, but not good for us. Hmm. Interesting.
You know, I heard this interestingly the other day from one of our physicians in the state where they've legalized marijuana.
Oh yeah.
You know, which is another.
We can talk about that. I don't know. I'm just fascinated by
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Another thing, and the great question was, well, listen, do you want? Well, you know, if marijuana was so difficult, why don't you do the outlaw cigarettes? They were much worse than marijuana.
True.
And the retort was, do you want your airline pilot smoking a cigarette or do you want him smoking a joint before he takes off with you in the plane?
That's good.
Okay. I mean, the cognitive effects of some of these mind-altering, mood-altering drugs is monumental. And yeah.
And I'm surprised by some of the research that's coming out on cannabis and its even modest use and its effect on young adult and adolescent brains. It's kind of striking. It's really kind of crazy.
It's huge.
Yeah, and tobacco doesn't do that. Tobacco rots their arteries and their lungs.
That's right. You're going to die a different death.
Yeah, it's not good. Neither are good. I don't like. Are you like me, where you don't like the arguments of good drugs and bad drugs? I don't. Right. That's not I don't see that. I just see the human's relationship with a substance. And
right.
For some people, genetically prone, environmentally triggered, it goes bad.
You know, I have a wonderful conversation with Keenan's dad. He runs a major ski area in Colorado, and here they are inviting families in all year long to partake of fun on the slopes. You bring the kids. You're going to have a great holiday. And X percentage of these young people that you hire seasonally are using their God-given right to smoke the marijuana that the state has now legalized. Mm-hmm. Now, these people run chairlifts, they drive snowmobiles, they're, you know, skating down at 40 miles per hour. You know, it's a huge... Huge.
Well, I actually would prefer that to what we have here in California, where everyone has their marijuana their prescription card, and the insurance is paying for their marijuana while they go skiing.
Yeah, I ain't really push my button, Drew. I have had patients, let me just say, close to the beach, who have literally sent their 18-year-old kids to the marijuana, and I put this in quotes, doctor, to get that card.
Yeah.
And the reason was that on Friday nights, on a rotating basis, they would give their basement to that group of kids so that they could all toke up together because it kept them off the streets.
Oh, my. That's interesting.
Isn't that
what I hate about the marijuana, the medicalization? Marijuana may have good uses medically. I believe that we may find that. But to have our profession perpetrate a sham, which is what this is, a political agenda, is what I object to.
You know, I practiced family medicine for 35 years in Vermont, and I had people on chemotherapy that had to use Marinol.
I've actually prescribed cannabis.
I've had people do it when they had glaucoma.
Like, listen, just like I prescribe morphine when some people need it. You know, it has utility.
It does have its place.
But the fact that near the water here in Southern California, you can ride your bike by and just reach your hand in the window of a dispensary and grab a card. Well, let me ask you this. What percentage of your addict patients needing hospital-based treatment have their marijuana card?
Oh, their card.
Their prescribing card.
I would say 40%.
Well, see, mine was always like 90%.
Yeah.
Ask them. Maybe you're not asking because you'll find it's way up.
We treat a lot of people from a lot of different states.
That's true. Right. You're not seeing the California group. Yeah. Right. I saw pretty much only California, and it was 90% plus.
That's for sure.
The only people that didn't were the old school alcoholics. So let me keep going around the horn. You know, let me do one other thing. Let me get some business out of the way so I can just have this done with. And this is about our friends at GoToMeeting. Of course, you know Adam and I talk about this all the time. And Dr. Hartunian and I could have a meeting about this very topic if we wanted to. And I suspect one day we will. And were we to, we would use GoToMeeting. You can obviously brainstorm. You can have an HD meeting. It's GoToMeeting with HD faces. So you're having this meeting right there on your computer with everyone present in real time. And you can throw your documents up and work on one another's documents in real time. GoToMeeting with Citrix, you share screens, it makes it easier for the team to be on the same page, and you turn your webcam into a video conference center, and you can do it anywhere, computer, mobile phone, tablet, it is easy. Obviously, we love GoToMeeting here. We use it for all the meetings with all the people that do business with the Corolla Network. Here's what I want you to do. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. Use the promo code Dr. Drew, D-R-D-R-E-W. That is GoToMeeting.com. That's G-O-T-O, not no numbers in there. GoToMeeting.com, promo code D-R-D-R-E-W. Meeting is believing. All right, so I'm going to go around more of my blind men. I wrote down, while you were talking, I was just writing down all the different groups that I thought were looking at the elephant through their own prism.
By the way, I should tell you, I don't think anybody will know me if you call me Dr. Haritunian. They call me Dr. Harry.
Oh, Dr. Harry.
All the time. It makes it much easier for you.
And I know that about you, too, because I've heard of you for many, many years. Just a reminder that Dr. Harry is the Physician Director of Professional Residential Programs at the Betty Ford Center, specializing in treating the most difficult of the addict populations, which are the professionals and celebrities and whatnot. How did you get involved in this? How did you get interested in it?
My own recovery. Yeah, I joyfully tell that story in the book. I was, the great light of spirituality came to me like it did for Bill Wilson. Mine was in my rearview mirror, and it was blue. End of story.
And twirling.
There you go. Someone suggested maybe it was time to get a little help. I have a family gravely afflicted by alcoholism, right, and it started sneaking up on me, and I got very proactive with it and found that I just embraced the work and changed
it's
my
really,
life.
People always wonder how you can do this work, you know, because there's a lot of bad outcomes with it. But the recoveries are so spectacular, so thrilling.
Just amazing.
Yeah, that's how I got involved with it. I watched a couple of recoveries happen. I was like, I want to see how that works. How does that happen?
There you go.
When your patients die today, how do they usually go out? What happens? Because I have a real specific thing that happens to my patients.
When they die.
If they're going to die of addiction, what's the sort of typical scenario these days?
Inadvertent overdose.
With?
You know, it's usually that lethal combination. They wind up getting a prescription for Ambien, thinking that's somewhat simple. They get hooked into Ambien or another benzodiazepine other than the Z drugs. They wind up usually having a pain pill on top of that.
Right, so
call it the Heath Ledger mix.
Absolutely.
And then they drink.
Okay. Well, mine don't always drink, but they always have the two pills. Yeah. They always have the benzo and the opiate, and they die.
That's right.
And so my patients die at the hands of my peers.
That's right.
Almost without – you said the same thing spontaneously. We have not discussed this. Almost without exception.
That's right.
Which is really a sad indictment. My heroin addicts don't die of heroin overdoses.
That's
right. My cocaine addicts don't die of strokes or accidents. Mm-hmm. They die of pills given to them by my peers. And by the way, not infrequently, I'm begging the patient not to go see these doctors.
That's right.
And at very minimum, I go, please don't talk about headache or back pain or sleeplessness. Do not talk about that.
Anxiety.
The second you do, it's over. Yeah. I don't care how. And the crazy thing is, oftentimes the patient will come in and say, I'm a severe drug addict. I value my recovery. I'm a terrible heroin addict. Really? Oh, you've got back pain? Well, why don't you try this Vicodin? Here's a limited supply, 30 pills. It's not that big a deal.
You know, if they came out and say, if you bought chicken in Joe's stores last week, warning, salmonella outbreak. If you have a prescription for Xanax, Ativan, Valium that's been given to you recently for any of the reasons that they are given, anxiety, you got to treat that like a salmonella outbreak. You got to go back, stop using them, go back, talk to your doctor, and say, why do I have this, and get a second opinion.
I hope they don't. I wish more would go back and educate those physicians, let them have it a little bit, too.
Well,
all right, let's take some calls. Dr. Harry and I are going to talk to everybody. We are starting with Pete on line one. He's 43, calling from Washington. Pete, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Dr. Drew. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Love the podcast. Here's my situation. I've got my wife is an active alcoholic. I've been going to Al-Anon, which has really helped me to sort of figure out what I can control and what I can't, and help me to kind of let go.
Hey, Pete, before you go further, hang on a second. We have not discussed codependency, which I'm sure we could do a whole other podcast on that. But I just want to say, congratulations. You've really taken an active role in her recovery and yours. So you've done what you can here. So good for you.
All right. Well, thank you. So we have an 11-year-old son, and I kind of have two questions, and these are the things that I'm that just constantly go through my head. One is balancing marital commitment with the sense that by staying together, I'm enabling my wife's behavior. And question number two is, which way am I setting a good example for my son? By staying together and potentially enabling this, or by trying to draw a line somehow?
I'll begin that, and Dr. Harry, I'll be interested to hear what you say, because it's I'm not sure there's an answer to this. But I would say for the child, a child, 11-year-old child needs two things. He needs his mom in recovery. Her recovery is everything to him. And he needs his parents together. That's what he wants anyway. That's what he will want, regardless of the implication of it from a standpoint of behavioral modeling. Now, there are, of course, exceptions to that if things get too crazy. So I'll let Dr. Harry keep going.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Drew. I think that this is a family disease, and without treating the family adequately, no one seems to get better. I want you, first of all, to know that we start screening kids for their own drug and alcohol use at 11 and 12. My son was stealing out of my medicine cabinet and out of my black bag when he was 11. He now has 9 or 10 years of recovery, thank God. But it starts early, and certainly this kind of situation at home could signal
on.
That.
Yeah.
As I understand it, your wife is still actively using, and you've been in Al-Anon, you know how to detach with love. You can be as supportive as possible, but I do think you need boundaries around her use of alcohol. And if that is not something she's ready to address, there may be a situation where you have to remove
yourself
and the child.
The one thing, yeah, that's what, if it gets crazy, you have to go. But Pete, I hear the anger you still have, and I would not react out of anger. That's where people get into trouble. Dr. Harry, heard him say detach with love. That's not with anger.
it is
with love.
That's a capital L on love. I think your commitment to your wife and your marriage is noble. And any way that you can get the help necessary to keep that family unit together should be a priority. But it may need a trial of an alternative arrangement, separation or otherwise, to get her attention enough to get into treatment.
Create consequences and yes. goals and then bring the axe down where you have to for people like this. Let's see. Here is Chris, 34, Chris in Phoenix. What's up, Chris?
Hi, doctors. I'm so glad you guys do this podcast. Thanks for taking my call.
Our pleasure.
So kind of here's the situation I'm in. I've been in recovery from alcohol and drugs for a little over 9 years now.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
Thank you. Also used to cut on myself. Don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. But the one habit I'm having trouble fully letting go of is bulimia. And that's kind of like my one thing where if I get too triggered, I still go to it. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, how do you work with someone who has just that one thing they can't fully give up?
I have a couple of reactions. I find it interesting that you call bulimia a habit. That's fascinating. If you so it suggests to me if you maybe not had eating disorder treatment.
Not specifically, no.
Okay, but you have an eating disorder. You have addiction, and you have an eating disorder. Now, sometimes the eating disorders get better just with addiction treatment. I've certainly seen that.
That's right.
Because the trauma stuff, the combination that you have suggests you're a trauma survivor, too, with the cutting and everything. So, I would say, you should look into eating disorder treatment, and B, have you had adequate trauma therapy?
I think I've had adequate trauma therapy. I've gone through multiple years, multiple times, multiple therapists.
Okay.
So
all right, Dr. Harry, don't you agree? Eating disorder is a separate condition.
Yeah, I would focus completely on the eating disorder. Yeah. The treatment has become so focused, laser focused, and successful that it would be a shame for you not to avail yourself of those wonderful treatments that are out there. And if you contacted me at the Betty Ford Center, just Dr. Harry, BettyFordCenter.org, I'd be happy to make some suggestions for you and steer you in the right direction.
There you go. Okay, Chris?
Thank you so much.
Oh, you betcha. It's funny how people don't think about. They don't think the way we think, I guess.
Is they the just, habit was interesting.
Yes, that's immediately where I knew that she had not had treatment.
Yep.
James, 18, Minnesota.
Dr. Drew, it's an honor.
It's our pleasure, my friend. What's up?
So I'm 18. I'm from Minnesota. My dad had a condition, I'd say probably back in 2000, that I'm sure you guys are familiar with. It's called a vascular necrosis.
Of his hips?
And
of his hips?
Yes.
Yeah.
His hips and his shoulders. And it eventually, over the next few years,
hey, James, ended up James, having, James, James, yes? though avascular necrosis of the hips in a young, relatively young man, he must have been in his 40s, really only happens in the setting of alcoholism, sometimes obesity, and then steroid use, like corticosteroid use, not anabolic steroid
Correct.
Use. So which category did he fit into?
The very first one, alcoholism.
That's what I figured. That's what I figured. Okay. Yeah. So you've been alcoholic, untreated, has avascular necrosis, for the listeners. Basically, fat that expands in, you know how your hip is a ball and socket? In the ball part, the fat expands in there, and it cuts the blood supply off to the surface of that ball, and it just breaks down. It has to be replaced.
Yes, that's exactly what I've read. And
oh, you're breaking up, James. James, you're breaking up. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. He had his hips and his shoulders replaced completely as a result of this.
Yeah.
And since then, he has been heavily addicted to prescription painkillers.
And let's be clear, the reason they replaced the hips and the shoulders for avascular necrosis is because it cures the pain. So the fact that he stayed on pain meds is so suspect. Well, it's a drug addict. It's just drug addict stuff.
Right? He's got a new independent issue.
Yeah, he can now he can justify using the opiates.
Right.
Right, and so my question essentially was, a few weeks back you had a guy on your podcast by the name of Barry Meyer, and you talked about prescription painkiller industries and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And throughout the show, you guys kept saying that there were tons of ways to cure pain that don't involve pills, but you didn't really elaborate.
Okay,
on
well,
what
that's
those
Dr. Harry's
were.
Specialization. He can give you. You probably didn't hear the beginning of this podcast. We got into a little bit. And maybe
I have recently called.
Okay,
yeah.
when this podcast goes up, listen to that beginning. I'll have
Absolutely.
Him address it again. Go ahead.
First of all, let me be sure that I tell you how much hope you have to look forward to. I'm speaking to you as a man with two artificial hips and one artificial knee. Mm. And never took the pain medications that they wanted me to take, except on the day one and two of surgery. So your dad has a lot of hope. Pain is not by any means inevitable. The pain he probably has now, as Drew so aptly pointed out, is probably due to the medications he's taking. And that has to be treated independently. He needs treatment for the most likely opiate addiction. And in Minnesota, I can tell you right now, there's programs all over the place. Hazleton is based there, Center City campus in St. Paul. There's all kinds of help for your dad.
Do you understand?
Okay, that's great to hear.
Yeah, go. Yeah. Hazleton is, you know, there's only a few places I can refer to now with impunity and not worry about what's going to happen to people. Because, I worry what they're going to do to them. It's Betty Ford. It is all the Hazleton places.
Yep.
It's going to basically be all the Hazleton
That's
places
right.
now. You can, and there are a number of them. I used to send people up to Springbrook. Particularly, and that's a big professional program, long-term
right.
program. But a Hazleton program, you can rely on good outcomes. Okay, so take your dad over there, get him evaluated, get him off this crap, and onto a flourishing existence again. Dana in Houston, 50. Dana?
Yes.
Hey, what's going on?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on.
Hi. I have a question. My sister, who is a alcoholic and I believe abuses her pain medication.
How old is she?
She's 48.
Okay.
And she's diagnosed with a severe rheumatoid arthritis.
And by severe, do you see the destruction of the joints? Does she have all the...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Since she was like 22.
Oh, boy.
So she has self-medicated and drinks on top of it. And we've been trying to get her to get in a program, but she declares that nothing is going to work for her because of her arthritis.
It's a really interesting situation.
Right.
So what do you do with the unmotivated...
The most important thing to ask you first, is she on a disease-modifying anti-arthritic regimen?
Yes.
Does she take an injection
Humira or one of these.
Enbrel, and one of those.
Yes.
She does.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So, again, she's probably one of those unfortunates trapped by her prescriptions. The prescription pills, difficult for her to believe, will produce pain of their own. And we've had many people with rheumatoid and other arthritides that have come into the center in the same situation, adequately taken care of just by their disease-modifying injection alone, and do very, very well. She needs to be treated for opiate addiction.
But she's not willing, though, and she's drinking. And she has no hope, I imagine, is what you see with her, right?
Her new thing is she says she's too depressed to do anything.
Right, right, which I'm sure she is.
Well, you know, sometimes that just starts, if she's been seeing a lot of physicians with a prescription pad, I'd get away from them and perhaps start talking to someone who doesn't have a prescription pad. They have to take time and listen to her. Someone with some compassion, that usually can just be a good counselor who's used to dealing with patients with chronic illness and pain. There certainly are many of them in Houston. If you call me at the Betty Ford Center or Dr. Harry at BettyFordCenter.org and send me an email, I can give you some referral sources in the Houston area. Does she live in Houston?
Yes, she does.
We have plenty of people down there who can help her.
Okay, thank you. I'll get that email off to you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Dan. That's a tough one, though.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, she is undoubtedly severely depressed. She has real rheumatoid arthritis, so she has
joint erosion.
She's going to have pain, and it's going to be nasty pain, and not even chronic pain. She's going through her day. She'll have sudden acute pains.
Tell us how old is?
Till 48.
48.
And she's an alcoholic, so she loves alcohol. Probably that's the only thing she loves in her life right now. You know, she doesn't really sound like an opiate addict per se. She's not going crazy with the opiates because she's too busy with her alcohol. Yeah, it's so hard, and she doesn't want to get better.
Yeah, that's a very, very difficult case. I wonder if she's on steroids.
You'll find out when she calls you.
Yeah.
They usually are a little bit.
Yeah,
with the stuff.
Usually.
And that's just making the depression worse and blah, blah, blah. But the interesting thing here is that here's one of the things that my recovering friends tell me is that, and this is something that non-addicts can't get their head around, is that it's hard to find something in your life you love as much as your substance of choice.
Oh, absolutely. It's a love affair.
Right. And that's something normies don't get, don't think, and they recoil when they hear it. Like, well, what about your children? What about your job? Yeah, not quite as much. Not quite as much as I like the alcohol.
Yeah.
That is, people hear that, particularly family members, and they get angry and they can't hear it, and it's hard to really get. And when you have, the most vivid version of that I heard was a kid I knew was an opiate addict. He's in recovery. He's doing well. And he had a couple of really serious near suicides, like with the gun in the mouth kind of thing. And both times, his it's going to sound convoluted, but his love of his drug of choice was so intense he couldn't leave it behind.
Yeah.
The thought of the grief of losing the love of the drug was enough to prevent him from killing himself.
Right.
And that is not a normie thought.
It's
that
amazing when you hear those stories to know that recovery absolutely works. We did another book, Lou Terracy, who's a neuroimager down in Orange County, and I did a book called Hijacking the Brain, which was published last year. And in there, we try to go after the evidence basis of neurochemical changes in recovery. The oxytocin, the nurturing, the imaging studies that have shown that.
You're doing SPEC or functional MRI?
Yes,
or all
both.
Of the above? And there's a massive change in your brain.
Yeah, I'll send you a copy.
I think
you'll find it very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. There's massive change.
That.
And probably the change continues over 5 years or so.
Absolutely.
I'm sure.
And so people just say, well, what is this thing recovery? It's actually a chemical event. It's really quite amazing.
The magic in it, to me, is not the transformation of the brain function, because that, to me, is matter of fact based on how I see people change. Look at this guy, Jason Waller. I can't recognize the guy anymore.
Yeah.
And he changed just one thing.
By the way, the other guy standing next to him, Kenan. I should tell you, Kenan, and when I first met him, fit into the palm of my hands was upside down with his bare butt showing, and I gave his immunizations. That's how long we've known each other.
But Jason came with the classic statement that he had to change, which I just love. He just had to change one thing.
Yeah.
Everything.
It was
the best.
Life.
The best.
He's done
best.
A good job.
Oh, my God.
Outstanding.
So it's the matter of fact thing to me is that the brain does change. That's a matter of fact. The magic, though, to me, is the moment of change.
Yeah.
That's the part I'm most interested in. How do you get people to get it, to be willing, make that commitment? That's the God part. And when people have it, it's so magical to them, they'll say, well, God stepped in. That's the only way I can understand. Something outside of me actually stepped in because it's so intense, I can't understand
that's
it any other
right.
way.
That's right. And the feeling that one gets is almost like you're going down for the third time. And that hand reaches down, just grabs you by the collar and pulls you back up onto the boat. And you know where you were going. You know where you are now. And that's a feeling that you want every single day.
That's the magic. If we could just help people get to that spot, we'd have a lot more recovering people.
Maintenance of our spiritual condition.
Being Sober is the book. Harry Harutunian is my guest, physician, director, professional, residential programs, Betty Ford Center. Obviously, he and I have a love fest that we could go on for hours massaging, but I have to wrap things up now. I do suggest you go to doctor.com, click through at the Amazon banner, and get Being Sober, step-by-step guide to getting through, and living in recovery. All of our callers today could benefit from this book, whether it's for them or family members. This is comprehensive and where you start right there. BettyFordCenter.org is the website. And Harry at the web.
Dr. Harry at BettyFordCenter.org or on our website. Just Google up Betty Ford Center and you'll find all the information you need.
Thank you for listening, everybody. And Dr. Harry, it's been a privilege. Hope
I really appreciate it,
Thank
Drew.
You so
Thank
much.
You so much.
Corolla Digital.